Welcome to Sensible Health Solutions, the show where we simplify health and wellness. Join your hosts, Haley Fields and Dr. Scott Looper, as they share practical tips and expert insight to help you navigate common ailments, nutrition, and overall well-being. Tune in for straightforward advice that empowers you to live a healthier life.
Hello, Dr. Looper.
Hello, Haley.
Continuing our conversation on women's health, I think your topic that you had suggested was fibroids. What are fibroids?
So the reason why we're talking about fibroids is because they kind of dovetail in with the conversation about menopause and difficult periods and kind of hormone balancing, because fibroids are one of the ways that hormone imbalances will show up in women. Fibroids...
Are they cysts?
They're not. Well, fibroids are a smooth muscle overgrowth in the uterus. Now, the funny thing about fibroids, with a name like fibroid, it makes you think they're fibrous, and they're not. It's a misnomer. They're not any more fibrous than the rest of the uterus is. What it is the uterus has layers to it. It's got some connective tissue layers. Those are the fibrous layers. And it's got some muscle layers. It's the muscle layer that overgrows. And what you get is this little blob. It's not cancer. It sounds like it's cancer because it's like these tumors. And they are tumors, but they're not malignant tumors. What they are is they're benign tumors of the uterus. And they're little, they start off as little specks of muscle. And then the muscle grows and grows and grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. And you get a lump in the wall of the uterus. Now, if this bump happens on the inside of the uterus, it may actually grow out into a blob, they call it pedunculated, which is there's a blob growing on a stalk. That's one kind of fibroid. And there's also fibroids that are just a bump on the inside of the uterus. So the outside is pretty smooth.
So on the inside wall and on the outside wall.
So the inside, it grows in the wall, but if this is the inside of the uterus and this is the outside, it grows like this.
Mm-hmm.
See the inside of the uterus? And then if it's on the outside and this is the inside and this is the outside, it grows on the outside of the uterus or grows in both sides of the uterus.
Okay.
Now the reason why, you may think, why is he going on about this? The reason why I mention it is because the more there is an increase in blobbiness on the inside of the uterus, the more there is a chance of having problems with periods, because you get more endometrial lining or thicker endometrial lining, or you get a blob that comes out in the center and there's just that much more endometrial lining, and you're going to get heavy periods and you're going to get painful periods and you're going to get symptoms that go with these. Because lots of times women who get these fibroids have no symptoms, because it doesn't cause a problem. It's not growing in the center. The endometrial lining is not affected in any way. It doesn't really do anything. It's this tiny little thing that doesn't cause any problems whatsoever. So fibroids are much, much more common than you realize. I'd say over a lifetime.
When does it become an issue then? Does it become painful at any point?
It can.
Does it debilitate the chances of becoming pregnant?
It can. Yes.
All of those.
Yeah. Now, let's get a sense of this. So, when does it become problematic? I'd say it depends on how big it is and where you're at in your life.
And then,
if it's big, chances is almost 100% it's going to be problematic. If it's tiny, the chances is almost 100% it's not going to be problematic. Also, the position of it. If it's on the inside, much more chance of it becoming problematic. If it's on the outside, much less chance of becoming problematic.
Can it become cancerous?
Yeah, but not any more than just the regular
tissues.
Yeah, tissues.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not any more. It's not like precancerous.
Okay.
It's just as likely to become cancerous as any other smooth muscle in the body. Not very much.
So can it be like extremely painful during menstruation?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Do you feel it outside of menstruation, during like ovulation or follicular phase? Okay.
Also, it can be a problem because if it gets big enough, it's heavy.
Okay.
And
you
it,
can feel it?
And you could feel it.
Oh.
And it presses on things. So imagine you got this big lump, you know, this, I don't know, 5-pound lump that's sitting right on your bladder. You think you're going to have to go pee a lot?
It can be 5 pounds?
Yeah. It could be 100 pounds.
So how long does it take to grow?
Years.
Okay.
Some grow fast, some grow slow. Some don't. Some grow and then shrink. Every combination you can think of is what they can do. So let me give you the normal rundown. Normally, they start growing in your early 30s, you know, late 30s, 40s. It could be as early as 20s. It's possible. And they tend not to have any problem whatsoever when you start. And as you get older, they tend to be more of a problem. About 20% of women in their 30s to early 40s have these. 50% of women over their lifetime have them. So common. And they tend to grow more when you got a lot of hormones in your body, when you're, you know, having, you know, you're having your normal menses and kind of in your 30s and early 40s is when they tend to grow more. If you can make it to where you're into menopause, they tend to either stop growing or shrink. Now, they don't always. Sometimes when you get into menopause, they turn on like crazy and grow like gangbusters. And you never know exactly how it's going to go. It's hard to predict exactly what they're going to do. But they seem to be affected by estrogen.
Okay.
They seem to be sensitive to estrogen. And that is the strategy
that I use. Overproduction of estrogen or underproduction?
Over.
Okay.
So estrogen, here's a kind of
thing. It's a growth
hormone. Let's talk about estrogen. Estrogen, by the way, is not one thing. So we're going to do a little mini lecture on estrogen. The estrogen, there's three of them. There's estrogen 1, estrogen 2, and estrogen 3. Estrogen 1 is known as estrone, and it stimulates things to grow mildly, you know, kind of. There's estrogen 2, which is estradiol. That's the strong one.
Mm-hmm.
That one's by far the more effective. If you want to use any one of these to treat something or to do some kind of therapeutic thing or to have birth control or something like that, it's the E2 that gives you way more bang for your buck. It's by far the strongest of the three. So most, when you take estrogen, almost always is E2,
okay.
Estradiol. E3 is estriol. And estriol is kind of weird. It's different from the rest of them. It tends to be protective of growing things. Women have high levels of estriol tend not to grow cancer. They tend not to have fibroids. It's like the one that balances the other two, kind of, the way to think about it.
Estrogen's these three sisters.
They're all different personalities.
Yeah.
Interesting, isn't
Very.
It? Yeah, and so if you want to do, in the olden days, if you wanted to actually put a patient on estrogen, you almost did it on estrogen 2, but now that's not done near as much. It's still done some, but much, much, much less common because of the cancer risk. So if you want to actually put someone on estrogen and have it be safe, what you do is you put them on what's known as triest, that is three, E1, E2, and E3 in proportion, and then the portions change depending on what you're trying to do, but you put it in proportional and you can get some kind of effect and have it be more safe. So the evidence is that the E2 is the one that's most stimulating to these fibroids. But there's mixed evidence. There's some evidence that progesterone has something to do with growing them. If you actually, anyways, I have to get into too technical. Let me just say, in my experience, if you can balance estrogen in a woman, the fibroids will shrink.
Okay.
So now the question is, how do we shrink them?
So you don't use the E3 to shrink it specifically. You want all levels
yes.
to be the same.
Yes, and we're not using E3 as a therapy.
Okay.
Unless we're going to do it with the other ones. And the reason why, let me just keep the thought here, is what we want to do is we want to recreate as close as we can nature.
Mm-hmm.
The natural way things are, because the chances of it working correctly is going to go way up if we just recreate what should have been there to begin with.
Right.
There's a good principle to go on.
Mm-hmm.
Including, can we not do any hormone whatsoever? Because that's really how it should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just have your body make its own hormone.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get estrogens to level out and balance, then you get your greatest chance of realistically stopping the growth of these. maybe shrinking them. Now, shrinking is hard, and so we need to talk about surgery, because surgery can be a godsend with these.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. If you got a really bad fibroid that's growing really big, you're 3 months pregnant and you're not pregnant at all, it could be like that. It could be like, I've had patients show up in my practice with that.
Oh, man.
And if it gets big enough, what you really, actually, realistically, what you need to do is you need to get them surgically removed, because there's so much actual meat.
And after you remove it, does it grow back?
It can. So what you want to do is balance your hormones. So all the hormone balancing stuff we're going to talk about needs to be done no matter whether you're going to do it in surgery or not. Okay. It's not like you do the surgery, you're one and done. Mm-hmm. Unless you have the surgery where you simply have your uterus removed.
That will do it.
If you want to have babies, then you don't want to have your uterus removed.
Right.
You can get the fibroid taken out and leave the uterus behind.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely doable. Now, it's in the olden days, it wasn't doable, because when you had these fibroids, you just had your uterus taken down. That was it. One and done. That's how it was done. But what I'm trying to think of, special and wonderful doctors. There's a special name for that.
Talented.
Breakers. Breakers of trail. Trail breakers.
Trailblazers
even. Now I'm thinking basketball. Anyways, those trailblazers figured out ways to take the tumor out and leave the uterus behind.
Okay.
And so they saved many a woman's ability to have kids.
Mm-hmm.
The tumors occasionally do grow back, so it's not a perfect treatment, but if you want to keep your fertility, it's a better way to do it. Also, it might just be a good idea just to keep your bits as best you can anyways, and just have it be a general rule not to have your parts taken out. I kind of feel that way about me, like I'm trying to minimize surgery. You know, if it's gone bad, you get taken out. But other than that, short of that, I'd rather keep it in.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Why you make more unnecessary cuts than needed?
Yeah, and so for a while it was popular, if you're going to get a hysterectomy and actually have your uterus removed,
mm-hmm.
Then might as well just take your ovaries, because, I don't know, you're not using them anyways because you're menopausal.
But the ovaries produce hormones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They do, in fact.
Yeah.
All the way through your life.
Uh-huh.
Just because you're not using them to make eggs anymore doesn't mean they're not functional. So really, that has fallen out of fashion.
Okay, good.
And isn't that lovely?
Yeah. I'm glad that we're learning so much. There are so many advancements on women's health. But
yes.
Also infuriated that it has taken so long.
Yes.
To invest in research into more than half the world's population of people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
All those things.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. And they're not putting in mercury fillings anymore, not near as much as they used to. Isn't that lovely?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So there's some options you have in terms of getting these fibroids removed. And surgery is something you should definitely look at. But a lot of women don't have the fibroids that are big enough, or their symptoms are not bad enough, or they get found because they get pregnant. And you think, well, how, if you got one of these things, I mean, how could you get pregnant? Well, it turns out just fine most of the time.
Can there be a situation where you shed it in your uterine lining?
It's possible. Normally what happens, though, is they shrink from the inside based on the effect your hormones change.
Okay.
The chances of any one of these things going away is slim, unless the hormone milieu changes. And we're really talking estrogen. Remember, estrogen is there to grow things.
Yes.
You take a skinny little girl like a twig, and her body makes estrogen, and she gets all these curves.
Yeah.
She fills out. She grows. And that's what estrogen does, is it grows things, particularly the parts of your body that are sensitive to estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your breasts and your uterus and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get the hormones to balance out, not too high, not too low, you got a chance of reabsorbing this fibroid that grew under the influence of the estrogen to begin with.
So this, again, is treated by helping the liver process.
Yeah, you see why we did all these shows together?
Uh-huh.
It's the same story every time we talk about this.
So what if you get fibroids and your liver is processing hormones appropriately? And you have, like, adequate levels of estrogen. Is that just like a one-off situation?
It's an unusual situation.
Okay.
You know, anything that can happen will happen. You know, Murphy's Law. If it can break, it'll break. So the thing, what we want to do in medicine is to figure out, why did it break? What's the kind of the setup that would make it more
and
likely
of course,
for it to happen?
This is always tested for. This isn't just like willy-nilly, like, oh, we think your estrogen is too high, we're going to do this. No, it's something that obviously you test for. See concrete numbers of, and then can pinpoint, that's too high of estrogen.
That's an excellent point you made. Let me expand that one. So, okay, if your estrogen is screwed up, then you want to do a blood test and check your estrogen. Except for estrogen, remember, there's three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, it's not only about estrogen, it's also about progesterone. And mm-hmm. not only that, it's about the precursors of stuff that turns into the estrogen, because maybe you're short or high in a precursor. So now you need to run a bunch of tests. All these cost hundreds of dollars a piece, and now I've just described a $2,500 panel of looking at your hormones. This is a hard sell for the insurance company.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of money just to explore. Now, thank goodness there's an innovative lab in Oregon that does the Dutch panel. The Dutch panel looks at all the hormones and hormone precursors and uses urine to do the test.
Mm-hmm.
So the price of doing the test is about a tenth of what it would be otherwise. And it gives us since it's so inexpensive, it gives us an opportunity to run a lot more tests, looking at a lot of other different kind of stuff that would relate possibly to the management of your hormones.
And it is very comprehensive.
Yeah, 50 different things this test measures.
Yes.
It's a fabulous
50
test.
50 different hormones.
It looks at adrenal function, it looks at neurotransmitters, it looks at markers of digestion and liver function, it looks at a whole bunch of stuff. It makes my job so easy because I just start flipping through the pages and I feel like I've just climbed to the top of the hill and I'm looking out at the plane.
Right.
And I can see where everything is, right?
And
all
so
the pieces.
Normally we recommend a Dutch Complete. Would we recommend in this instance for fibroids like a Dutch sex hormone panel?
Depends on what the situation is. So now we don't have any stock in the precision lab.
Yeah, of
course.
So
we're not trying to sell anything.
We're not promoting.
Here. We're just talking.
Yeah.
So there's this test. See.
Yeah.
And it's super doable. Helpful.
It's doable at an affordable rate. And
yeah, and what I normally see in that test is the estrogens, particularly E2, because there's three of them. The E2 is high, and the testosterone is low, and that's what I end up seeing. I end up seeing this skewed thing. Or the ratio is wrong between the different kinds of estrogen. And so I could see, we have what's known as an estrogen dominant situation, or progesterone is low compared to something's out of balance. So then in that case, what we do is just figure out how to get it to go back into balance. And normally you could do herbs to get it to done.
Castor oil
to get
pack?
It fixed. Yeah, castor oil packs are one way.
Hydrotherapy, raising temperature.
Yeah, raise the temperature, and the liver works better, and then the hormones just get balanced on their own.
Exercise and sleep.
Yes, mm-hmm. All of those things are super helpful,
mm-hmm.
really. And then the other thing I was thinking of is doing some kind of estrogen cream or an estrogen blocker, or we got that Aromastat, stuff that we use to block the conversion of testosterone into estrogen, and so the testosterone stays higher, the estrogens go down low, and the symptoms clear, and sex drive goes up, and everything just kind of moves in the right direction. And it's a simple thing to do. It's a bunch of herbs put into a pill. It's a simple thing to take. Now, only though if you run the test and see that it's broken. Notice that we never treat fibroids with a pill. Just as a matter of course, because it's a stupid way to do it. Because if it's not broken, you can't fix it. So if it turns out that the hormones are fine and there's something else going on and you fix the hormones, nothing happens. No one gets better. If you find that the hormones are all screwed up and then you fix the hormones, now people got a chance of getting better because you fixed the thing that was broken. This is a duh. Of course it's a duh. Except for almost no doctor does it like this. What the doctor does is they come up with a diagnosis. You have fibroids. So now we do the fibroid treatment, right? Then mostly the fibroid treatment is to get surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But if you dig a little deeper, Because you know that fibroids are sensitive to hormone. Okay, can we run a hormone test?
Yeah.
Let's see what the hormones are.
Yeah.
And let's see what else will affect the hormone balancing. Turns out the liver does. So we're going to run a liver test.
Mm-hmm.
And the digestive system has a lot to do with what the liver's doing. So we're going to run a digestion test. And now we know what's going on. We can see exactly how the connection between these things, where the breakdown is, and you go through and then you fix it. It's common sense. The easier way to say this is we run enough tests and we find something that's broken.
Yeah.
And then we fix it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm gathering that the solution to the last three episodes that we've done is essentially the same.
Yes.
It is. And the same
fix herbs, the liver, get the hormones get fixed.
Yeah.
And then you, by fixing the liver, you've actually balanced the hormones more than anything else. The funny thing is if you think about this, you think, well, why don't we work on the ovaries where the hormones are being made? Or why don't we work on the adrenals where the hormones are being made? Well, the problem is it's not the hormones being made.
Yeah.
It's the balancing.
Well, is it the hormones being made when it's too much E3?
Can be. It's a possible. That's one of the things that could break.
Mm-hmm.
Is it mostly that? No. No, it's not. Mostly it's balancing the hormones is what it is. A lot of times...
And you can work on both of those things in tandem.
More likely it's the liver. Second most likely is adrenal. Third most likely is the ovaries. So the reason why we focus on the liver is because it's more likely to get an improvement in the case
mm-hmm.
by fixing the thing that's actually broken.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you got two things that are broken. Then we'll work on both of them at the same time.
Yeah, if it's processing all of the hormones as it should, then there wouldn't be an overproduction of specific hormones.
Yeah. So let's change the subject a teeny bit here because some of our listeners are going to be wondering about soy. Because clearly,
on soy last episode very briefly.
If there's an overstimulation of estrogen, the estrogen balance is not there. Estrogens are piling up. They're affecting affecting the muscle of the uterus, making it grow. And so it's estrogen. So clearly, we need to avoid soy because soy's got estrogen in it, and this is going to be a problem because it's got phytoestrogens. And the answer to avoiding soy is it's a bad idea. In fact, you're going to be much better off by eating soy to help decrease the effect of the natural estrogens in your body. So, you give me that look.
It cancels each other out?
Yes.
Huh.
Here's the
phytoestrogens?
Cancel the regular estrogen.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Because they fight estrogen?
Well, the way the estrogen works is it stimulates a receptor on the outside of the cells. The cell's got this estrogen receptor. Estrogen fits in, triggers the reaction, stuff happens. Mm-hmm. Phytoestrogen fits the same receptor, but it doesn't trigger the action.
Doesn't do the stuff.
Has a much, much milder effect. Not a strong effect, has a weak effect. Remember, there's E1 has a weak effect, E3 has a protective effect. They all interact with the receptor. So, anyways, you get the phytoestrogen coming in, it blocks the receptor. Now it's estrogen sitting, so-called estrogen, phytoestrogen, is sitting in the receptor. The real estrogen ready is banging on the door, wanting to come in and grow stuff.
Yeah, wouldn't that make a overproduction of the real estrogen out there if the phytoestrogen was taking its place and then your body kept signaling to make real estrogen?
Yeah, to do what? Doing nothing, though. It's floating around doing nothing.
Oh.
Waiting to be picked up by the liver and looked at and thrown away if it's old.
Okay.
And then it never did its job, never had to stimulate anything, and then, whoop, off you go. So if you got overstimulation, soy is one of the ways to protect against that.
Hmm.
So let's look at, aside from the theory, let's just look at cultures. So cultures that eat a lot of soy, Japanese,
mm-hmm.
they eat a lot of soy. They eat tofu, and they eat miso, and they get soy in all different kinds of things. I mean, soy sauce, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have much less problems with estrogen type problems like
breast cancer,
fibroids, the whole kin caboodle. Everything we've talked about. Endometriosis, all of them.
Okay.
They're much less. Now, particularly in the previous generation, because they were actually eating Japanese food.
Yeah.
This current generation's eating McDonald's and fast food, and now their numbers are going right up as much as
any other population is. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, in Okinawa, they have a reputation for living over 100. Except for not the newest generation.
Oh no.
They're eating junk food.
Oh.
And the health markers, they haven't got to the point to die yet, but their health markers indicate that they're not going to live any longer than, you know, people from California or wherever. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So it turns out soy is super helpful with this. And so it's something that I have patients do. Estrogen. There's other places where estrogen could come from. Not only your
ovaries
and your adrenal glands, but also your fat.
Okay. Is it stored in the fat?
It's made in the fat.
How?
Because fat is an endocrinely active tissue in the body. And if you have lots of fat, the fat itself makes estrogen.
Fat?
It's manufactured within the fat cells.
Okay, so fat cells respond to the endocrine system and...
And make it.
And make,
they make hormones.
Their own hormones. If you have too much fat...
Then you're making too much hormones.
Okay.
Huh. Interesting, isn't it? How did that ever get invented?
Why is fat making hormones?
I don't know.
Are they making up for the mass associated to the increase of fat? And because there's more mass here, we need more hormones, and these... You know, ovaries can't do the job. This adrenal can't do the job.
So back in the old days, girls often had their period at the age of 16.
Yeah, no, it's getting younger and younger. I think
150
like,
years ago. Was that the average age or was that just near average?
By my generation, it was 11, 12. And now the newer generation is like 9. And... Unfortunately, with the age that we live in, there is a lot of child obesity. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yep. There you go. So if you're well fed, then you are better positioned to be able to breed because you got enough reserve to make a baby.
Right.
And if you're super skinny, you don't have enough reserve.
No.
And
you
so
can't
you can't
produce
make a baby.
The milk. You can't carry the...
So if you're a super athlete, you're an elite athlete, and you're a bike racer or runner or something, and you're super thin, it's not uncommon for you to quit having a period. Because your body recognizes this is not a good time to have a baby, because clearly you're under a lot of stress.
That's what happened to me. I was bodybuilding. I quit having a period.
Yeah.
After I... did the competition, I stopped working out so hard and accidentally got pregnant.
There you go.
Because my body was healthy, I was eating right, and I put on a little bit more fat, and so the body was like, okay, we can be a host now.
Yep, because you're ready.
Yep.
Yep. So it's interesting that the one of the strategies of shrinking fibroids is to lose weight.
Oh.
Now, it's easier said than done. It takes some work to do it because the more estrogen you have, the more you tend to put weight on.
Yeah.
It also tends to be that weight that you put down on your thighs.
Yeah, and I would consider it to be difficult to exercise under, like, that condition with that uncomfortable feeling in your uterus.
Yes.
So
that's correct.
That sucks.
Yeah.
We are out of time for this episode, Dr. Looper.
Well... We gave it a good go.
Yeah, it jumped around a few times, but we landed.
Haley, thank you. This is much, much, much funner to do with you helping, so I appreciate it.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Looper.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Sensible Health Solutions. We hope you found today's discussion enlightening and packed with practical tips to enhance your wellness journey. Remember, small changes can lead to big results. If you enjoyed the episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us bring you the best content possible. Stay connected with us on social media for more health insights and updates. You can find us at Sensible Health Solutions across all social platforms. Until next time, stay sensible and stay healthy. This content is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Seek medical advice from a healthcare professional for any medical conditions.